Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lien and I'm a fourth-year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin, I'm a family practice resident at UBC. We're excited to bring you guys the next chapter of the Family Farm Podcast, a chapter on pediatrics.
Pediatrics is a large part of family practice and community pharmacy, so some topics we plan to cover include pediatric fever, antibiotics for children, asthma, allergies, and ADHD.
Again, we'll cover national guidelines whenever possible and throw in EBM specials to highlight controversies we've discovered along the way.
So we hope you will find the pediatric episodes helpful. Again, we welcome any feedback you may have.
Without further ado, let's start with pediatric fever. In preparation of our discussion on pediatric fever, we tried to look for a Canadian national guideline. However, the Canadian Pediatric Society does not appear to have a recent guideline on the investigation and management of pediatric fever. Therefore, we look towards UK and the NICE guideline. NICE stands for National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, and they have a guideline published in May of 2013 on feverish illness in children, assessment and initial management in children younger than 5 years. Of course, we'll put a link to this UK guideline in our show notes. The guideline is very clearly laid out into some logical sections. The first section is the detection of fever. The recommendation around this topic is slightly different from the CPS recommendation on measuring temperature in pediatrics. The UK guideline stated that oral and rectal temperature measurement should not be routinely used in measuring body temperature of children aged 5 years and below. And instead, in infants under age 4 weeks, body temperature should be measured with an electronic thermometer in the axilla. And for children between 4 weeks to 5 years, body temperature could be measured in the axilla with a chemical dot thermometer in the axilla or with an infrared tympanic thermometer. And forehead chemical thermometers are not reliable and should not be used. And very importantly, they have another recommendation that reported parental perception of a fever should be considered valid and taken seriously. In other words, if the parent of the child tells you that the baby has had a fever, even though they don't have a thermometer at home, the parental perception of fever is a fever. For those of us in Canada, the CPS guideline does have something to say regarding body temperature measurement. And their recommendation is that for children between birth and 2 years, the definitive measurement is rectal temperature, and to screen, an axillary temperature is acceptable. And for children between 2 to 5, again, the rectal temperature is definitive, but axillary or tympanic measurements is good for screening. And for children older than 5 years, an oral temperature is definitive, and axillary or tympanic measurement is good for screening. The CPS guideline also offered some normal ranges for the different measurement methods. For rectal temperature, the normal range is 36.6 to 38 degrees. For the year, it's 35.8 to 38 degrees Celsius. And for oral, it's slightly lower at 35.5 to 37.5 degrees Celsius. And the axillary route has the lowest normal temperature range of 34.7 to 37.3 degrees Celsius. And this makes sense as the body temperature is taken further away from the core, the normal range drops. The major difference between the CPS recommendation and the UK recommendation on measurement of body temperature is the routine use of rectal and oral routes. The UK guideline mentioned that this is a point of controversy, and they did cite some concerns regarding the extremely rare complication of bowel perforation with rectal temperature measurements. Okay, now let's talk about the assessment of pediatric fever. Of course, in assessing a child with fever, the very first step should be ABCs, and that is airway, breathing, and circulation. And as well, if the child has decreased level of consciousness, then we need to worry about immediate life threats and then manage them acutely in a resuscitation capacity. For the less emergent cases, the UK guideline uses the traffic light system for identifying risk of serious illness in a child with fever. And their traffic light apparently has green, amber, and red color. And green corresponds to low risk, amber is intermediate risk, and red is high risk for serious illness in children with fever. So let's look at what this traffic light system entails. It's basically an assessment of several different clinical features in a child with fever. And this includes color of the skin, activity of the child, respiratory status, circulation, hydration, and the other category. In assessing the appearance of the child, green or low risk means the child has normal color. Amber means the child has pallor reported by the parent. And if the child is pale, mottled, ashen, or blue in color when examined by the medical professional, then the child is in the high risk or the red category for color. For activity, a low-risk kid responds normally to social cues and is content and smiles and has normal social interaction. And the child stays awake or is awakened quickly. And the child has normal cry or is content and not crying. For a child in the intermediate risk group or the amber group, the child is not responding quite normally to social cues, is not smiling, and only wakes with prolonged stimulation. Also, the child will have decreased activity. And if the child has no response to social cues, appears ill to the healthcare professional, or does not wake or does not stay awake, and has a weak or a high-pitched cry, then the child is considered to be in a high risk for serious infection. In terms of respiratory status, a low-risk kid should not have any signs or symptoms of respiratory distress, whereas an intermediate risk, the child could have nasal flaring, tachypnea, and that means a respiratory rate of greater than 50 breaths per minute in children aged 6 to 12 months, and greater than 40 breaths per minute in children greater than 12 months of age. And if the child has oxygen saturation less than 95% in room air, or if the child has crackles in the chest, then they are considered to be in an intermediate risk. For a high-risk child, they would exhibit grunting, tachypnea that's severe and greater than 60 breaths per minute, or moderate or severe chest indrawing. For circulation and hydration status, for a low-risk child, they'll have normal skin and eyes, and they'll have moist mucous membranes. For a child in intermediate risk, they'll have tachycardia, and this is defined as greater than 160 beats per minute in children under 12 months of age, greater than 150 beats per minute in children between 12 to 24 months of age, and greater than 140 beats per minute in children between 2 to 5 years of age. Other signs of intermediate risk include capillary refill time greater than 3 seconds, or dry mucous membranes, poor feeding in infants, and reduced urine output. For a high-risk child, they will have reduced skin turgor, which is a delayed sign of dehydration. And for the other category, a low-risk child would have none of the amber or red symptoms or signs. A child with intermediate risk will have high fever of greater than 39 degrees Celsius, or fever for greater than 5 days with rigors, or if they have swelling of a limb or a joint, or if they're not weight-bearing on the limb or not using an extremity, then they're at an intermediate risk for a serious infection. And obviously for the latter two, with a swelling of a joint or not using a joint, we're concerned with septic arthritis. Now, for the high-risk group, if the child is under 3 months of age and has a fever of greater than 38 degrees, or if they have non-blenching rash, bulging fontanelle, neck stiffness, status epilepticus, focal neurological signs, or focal seizures, then they are at high risk for infection. Besides using the traffic light system to assess the risk of a serious infection in a child with fever, the UK guideline also recommends measuring and recording the temperature, heart rate, respiratory rate, and capillary refill time as a routine assessment of the child with fever. And as already mentioned, the traffic light system includes tachycardia as an assessment of a risk for the circulation and hydration status. And just to review, for children under 12 months of age, if the heart rate is greater than 160, then they're considered to be tachycardic and at least in the intermediate risk group or the amber group. For children between 12 to 24 months, the tachycardia definition is greater than 150. And for children between 2 to 5 years, tachycardia definition is above 140. embedded in the travelex system is the recognition of different height of the fever having different clinical significance. So for children under 3 months, a fever of 38 degrees Celsius or higher means the child is in a high risk group for serious illness. Whereas for children between 3 to 6 months of age, a fever of 39 degrees Celsius or higher are in at least an intermediate risk group. For children older than 6 months of age, though, it's not recommended to use height of the fever alone to identify those with serious illness. The UK NICE guideline also provided a summary table for symptoms and signs suggestive of specific diseases, and this was added in 2013. So for meningococcal disease, some signs and symptoms include non-blanching rash, particularly with one or more of the following, an ill-looking kid, lesions larger than 2 millimeters in diameter, which is purpura, capillary refill time of greater than 3 seconds, or neck stiffness. Although I've always been taught that neck stiffness is not a reliable sign to look for in children with meningitis, because the musculature in the young child may not be developed enough to produce a neck stiffness, even with bacterial meningitis. A second diagnosis, bacterial meningitis, and some signs and symptoms include neck stiffness, bulging fontanelle, decreased level of consciousness, or convulsive status atelecticus, which is a prolonged seizure. For herpes simplex encephalitis, the child could have focal neurological signs, focal seizures, or decreased level of consciousness. Moving away from the CNS system, if the child has pneumonia, they could have tachypnea with a respiratory rate of greater than 60 breaths per minute between ages of 0 to 5 months, greater than 50 between 6 to 12 months, or greater than 40 above 12 months. And they could have crackles in the chest. They could have signs of respiratory distress, such as nasal flaring and chest indrawing. And they could have cyanosis and desaturation and oxygen saturation of less than 95%. For a child with urinary tract infection, they really don't have a lot of focal signs, and therefore it needs to be considered in any child younger than 3 months of age with fever. And they could have some vague symptoms such as vomiting, poor feeding, lethargy, irritability, or abdominal pain or tenderness. And in some cases, they could have urinary frequency or dysuria, but the child has to be old enough to express pain upon urination. For a child with septic arthritis, there could be swelling of a limb or joint, and the child may not be using that extremity and may not be weight-bearing. Finally, for Kawasaki disease, the fever could last for more than 5 days, and it should have at least 4 of the following. Number 1, bilateral conjunctival injection, and that should be non-exudative. Number 2, change in mucous membranes, and that could include strawberry tongue or cracking of the lips. Number 3, changes in the extremities, and that could include swelling or desquamation of the fingers or the toes. Number 4, polymorphous rash, and this is quite an unspecific maculopapular rash. Number 5, they could have cervical lymphadenopathy, that's greater than 1.5 centimeters. If the child does not have 4 out of the 5 symptoms, they could still have incomplete or atypical Kawasaki's disease, and there is further evaluation that could be used to diagnose a child with incomplete Kawasaki's disease. And we may cover the topic of Kawasaki's disease specifically in a separate podcast. Okay, so now we learned how to assess a child with fever, but how do we manage it? The UK guidelines separated their recommendations into management by the non-pediatric practitioner and management by the pediatric specialists. So for a non-pediatrician, such as emergency doctor or a family doctor, if there is any ABCD problems, including the airway, breathing, circulation, and disability or decreased level of consciousness in the outpatient setting, then they should call the ambulance and transfer the patient urgently to the emergency room. And these critically ill patients might require pediatric ICU admission. In other situations, after assessing the children with the traffic light system, if the child has any red features or high-risk features, they should be referred urgently to a pediatrician. And if the child does not have any red symptoms, but they have some amber features, and they do not have a firm diagnosis, then they could be referred to a pediatric specialist or discharged with a safety net approach. And the safety net could include explanation of the red flag symptoms for which they should urgently seek health care and how to arrange the further health care when needed. And they should arrange a further follow-up with the patient at a specific time and place. And if applicable, they could liaise with other healthcare professionals, such as the out-of-hours providers, to ensure that the children have continuous access to healthcare when needed. Finally, if the child has all the green features and none of the amber or red features, they could be discharged home with appropriate advice, including comfort measures in treating the fever, as well as the red flag signs for which to seek further medical attention. In terms of testing, even if the child has symptoms and signs suggesting of a pneumonia, if they're not admitted to the hospital, the recommendation is not to routinely order a chest x-ray. And in terms of urinary tract infection, there's a separate guideline that we will summarize, but suffice it to say that if urinary tract infection is suspected, a urinalysis and urine culture should be done before starting antibiotics. And that is actually a specific guideline recommendation for the doctor to not prescribe oral antibiotics to children with fever without a parent source. And I would add that for urinary tract infection, it's very important to get a culture before starting an antibiotic. And a reasonable approach to do this is to have the patient take the lab requisition and the prescription for antibiotics and go to the lab first and to give a urine sample and then go and fill the prescription for antibiotics. If the culture comes back negative, then they can stop the antibiotics. But this is not a part of the UK guideline, but more of a clinical teaching from my preceptors throughout the years. Perhaps more interestingly, let's talk about management of fever by the pediatric specialist. And their recommendation is that on top of the assessment described earlier using the traffic light system, for infants younger than 3 months of age with fever, the following tests should be ordered. Full blood count or complete blood count, blood culture, CRP or C-reactive protein, urinary tests including urinalysis and urine culture and sensitivity for UTI, and order a chest x-ray only if respiratory signs are present, and order a stool culture only if diarrhea is present. Now, you may be wondering, what about lumbar puncture? So lumbar puncture is recommended in the following children with fever. Number one, all infants younger than 1 month of age with fever automatically gets a lumbar puncture. For infants between 1 to 3 months of age who either appear unwell to the clinical assessment, or they have abnormal white blood cell count, and that could be less than 5 or greater than 15 times 10 to the power of 9 per liter. And for any child who would require lumbar puncture, they would also require empiric treatment with a parenteral antibiotic. So that's, again, infants younger than 1 month with fever or infants between 1 to 3 months of age who appear unwell or have abnormal white blood cell count. And the empiric antibiotic for children younger than 3 months of age, a third generation cephalosporin such as cefotaxime or ceftriaxone should be given plus an antibiotic active against listeria, for example, ampicillin or amoxicillin. So as you can see, we're quite aggressive in investigating and treating children under 3 months of age. For children aged 3 months or older, if they have fever without apparent source, and if they have one or more of the red features, then they need complete blood count, blood culture, CRP, and urinary testing. And if they have red features, and lumbar puncture, chest x-ray, and serum electrolytes and blood gases could also be considered, but these are guided by clinical assessment. In a child who is a little less sick and then do not have any red features, but they do have amber features, then they need urine testing, complete blood count, CRP and blood cultures again, and lumbar puncture for children younger than 1 year with amber features should be considered, and chest x-ray for a child with a fever greater than 39 degrees Celsius or a white blood cell count greater than 20 times 10 to the power of 9 per liter. So the major difference between the amber-featured and the red-featured child is the aggressiveness in terms of ordering lumbar puncture and chest x-ray. Lumbar puncture is reserved for children under 1 year of age if they only have amber features, and chest x-ray is only ordered for children with high fever greater than 39 degrees Celsius and a white blood cell that's greater than 20. Now, if the child is really, really not sick in the green group with no features of amber or red signs, that would indicate any serious serious illness, they should still have urinary testing for urinary tract infections. As already mentioned, urinary tract infection symptoms are unreliable in children. But for children in green group, even though they have fever, it's recommended that they do not routinely perform blood tests and chest x-rays. So that covers the investigations for pediatric fever. Now let's talk about treatment. In children with fever and presentation of shock, they should be given intravenous fluid boluses of 20 mL per kilogram. And this is typically a normal saline bolus. And they should be closely monitored and given further fluid boluses as necessary. For children who appear to be in shock, unrousable, or showing signs of meningococcal disease, they should be given parenteral antibiotics. A third-generation cephalosporin, such as cefotaxime or ceftriaxone, to cover the likely causes of serious infection, such as Neisseria meningitidis, Streptococcus pneumonia, E. coli, Staph aureus, and Haemophilus influenza type B. For children younger than 3 months of age, antibiotic coverage for Listeria should also be given, and this is typically ampicillin or amoxicillin. If the child has fever and symptoms of herpes simplex encephalitis, then they should receive intravenous acyclovir. Finally, if the child has signs of shock or oxygen desaturation lower than 92%, they should receive oxygen therapy. And of course, considerations for pediatric ICU should be given to any children who appears to be in shock. Now, how about antipyretic interventions? Well, the reason to treat fever with antipyretics is not to prevent febrile convulsions, because treatment with antipyretics, such as acetaminophen or ibuprofen, are not shown to decrease the risk of febrile seizures. Therefore, antipyretics should only be given if the child is distressed by their fever for comfort measures. The UK guideline does not recommend giving both agents simultaneously, and there is no need to routinely recommend alternating the two agents. And they recommend only to consider alternating these two agents if the distress persists or recurs before the next dose is due. Besides treating discomfort, there is no reason to give acetaminophen or ibuprofen just for a body temperature of greater than 38 degrees, because there is no clinical benefit for treating a number that suggests fever if the patient is not in any distress. Finally, if the child is not sick enough or became well enough to be discharged home and have their fever managed at home, the UK guideline provided some advice for home care. First of all, they can give acetaminophen or ibuprofen, as described earlier, to treat fever with the distress. Otherwise, it's recommended to offer the child regular fluids, because a febrile child has a higher insensible loss of fluids, and they're at risk for dehydration. And the parents should be taught how to detect signs of dehydration, and these include sunken fontanelle, dry mouth, sunken eyes, absence of tears, or a poor overall appearance. And the parents are encouraged to check their child during the night and to keep their child away from nursery or schools when the child still has a fever. And the parents should seek further medical attention if the child develops a seizure, develops a non-blenching rash, or if the parent feels that the child is less well and they're more worried now, or if the fever lasts longer than 5 days and may satisfy the definition of Kawasaki's disease, or for any other reason the caretaker is more distressed or concerned and unable to look after their child at home. Okay, so now for a quick summary of the UK's NICE guideline on pediatric fever. The traffic light system looks at the child's color, activity, respiratory status, circulation and hydration status, and overall clinical picture, and it separates the child into low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk for serious infections. In terms of the height of the fever, if the child is under 3 months of age, if they have a fever of greater than 38 degrees Celsius, then they're considered to be in the high-risk group. If the child is between 3 to 6 months of age, a high fever of greater than 39 degrees Celsius puts them into an intermediate risk group. If the child has any signs and symptoms of meningitis, then they're at a high risk. But if they have any signs and symptoms of septic arthritis or Kawasaki's disease, then that puts them into an intermediate risk group. Otherwise, the traffic light system is quite intuitive. If the child is mildly lethargic, then they're in the intermediate risk group. But if they have a significantly decreased level of consciousness, then that puts them in the high risk. And the same applies to respiratory status and circulation and hydration status. In terms of investigation, the younger the child, the more aggressive the investigation. For children under 1 month of age, if they have fever, then they should get a complete workup, including a lumbar puncture. Between 1 to 3 months of age, if they are unwell or if they have an abnormal white blood cell count, then they also might need a lumbar puncture. And the rest of the full workup includes a complete blood count, blood culture, CRP, urine testing, and chest X-ray if they have respiratory symptoms, and stool culture if they have diarrhea. If a child is sick enough to require lumbar puncture, then they require empiric parenteral antibiotic treatment, and this is usually a third generation cephalosporin plus or minus an ampicillin. For children older than 3 months of age, the level of investigation depends on their clinical picture. If they have any red features, then they need the full workup and serious consideration for lumbar puncture. If they only have amber features, then lumbar puncture should be considered if they're younger than 1 year of age. Finally, if the child has no red or amber features and they're in the green group, they should still get a urine test for urinary tract infections. And that concludes this podcast. As mentioned, we have a lot more episodes planned for pediatrics. And if there's anything in particular that you think we should cover, please do drop us a line. And again, we welcome any feedback that you may have. And you can visit us at fppodcast.org or comment and rate us on iTunes Store. So until next week, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.